Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LeDuc, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing some important news items from that week. On Wednesday, September 20th, Joe was joined by Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Icarius-Kelly, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, Preceptor in Public Speaking for the Faculty Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, and Editor-at-Large, Columnist, and Editorial Writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz.
The allegation was a bombshell that India had been involved in the killing of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil in the month of June. Canada's prime minister leveled the charge Monday, and an all-out diplomatic war soon followed. Canada pressed its allies to come together to challenge India, with statements of concern issued in Washington and Australia. India moved to expel a top Canadian diplomat in a tit-for-tat move, and Indian officials lined up to air grievances with Canada. But behind the plunge in relations to what officials and analysts called the lowest point ever were years of diplomatic tension. In New Delhi's eyes, Western nations, most notably Canada, have stood idly by as extremist Sikh groups, including the one led by the murdered Canadian citizen, have supported a sectionist cause that threatens the Indian state. Indian officials have accused their counterparts in Canada, Britain, and the United States of inaction as the diaspora mobilization from this independent nation that Sikh sectionists want to establish in the Punjab region has vandalized Indian diplomatic missions and threatened Indian diplomats. That from the New York Times. Vera, let us begin with you.
So there are so many things we can talk about. At the core of this issue is the fact that it looks like President Narendra Modi, a Hindu nationalist, has given orders, authorized the assassination of a Canadian citizen. Now, we're all awaiting more details on this, but clearly Trudeau has communicated with Western allies, in particular with the U.S., the Brits, and the Australians on this issue, because the Canadians, just like the other countries I mentioned, host the largest Sikh diaspora. Diaspora is the term for, you know, the ethnic community that lives outside of their homeland. So about 800,000 Sikh Canadians or Sikh live in Canada. They are pretty well organized, as well as those that live in the United States, the UK, and Australia. Further evidence is disclosed on this assassination, we have a new chapter in Indian foreign policy, parallel to be established to what President Erdogan of Turkey has done in terms of authorizing assassination of ethnic Kurds in Europe. So if, in fact, Prime Minister Narendra Modi authorized the assassination of a Canadian Sikh citizen, we have a major global crisis at our hands. India has increasingly turned nationalistic. Modi is focusing on isolating ethnic and religious minority communities. We might have noticed that Muslims and Christians and now Sikh have been targeted in various parts of India. The Sikh population predominantly they live in other states as well, but we're looking at Punjabi state within India, which is in northern India. Going back to colonialism, we can thank the British for having segregated the Sikh population between, now what is now Pakistan and what is now India. So this particular ethno-religious movement, the Khalistan independence movement by the Sikh, was very active and quite violent in the 80s and early 90s. Now, they haven't really been extremely well-organized or powerful in India at all. The center of power was in the diaspora. However, it looks like Modi is trying to strengthen his position by targeting minority communities and reinitiating hostilities towards the Sikh population. Now, Trudeau is also an interesting story because his general support from the Canadian electorate is shrinking. He's not as popular as he once was, and this is an opportunity for him to shore up his, you know, credibility inside the country to say, hey, if another country encroaches on the rights of Canadian citizens, I will confront them as hard as I can to protect the rights of free speech in Canada, and I will communicate out to my strongest allies and those countries that also have a large Sikh minority community. To wrap up my comments, this is a major problem for the idea that Biden had to bring Modi and India into the larger fold to separate India further in terms of economic, you know, relationships with Russia and to strengthen support and engagement with the Ukrainians.
Bob Griffin.
Yeah, Vera, thank you. Those were, I thought, some really compelling issues. A couple of other issues I'll toss on the table, Joe. This has some really serious potential ramifications as far as our China policy. So India plays a huge role in sort of our efforts to counter China's expansionist policies in and around Asia and the Pacific Ocean. So when we start to think about a reaction to this situation, understand that there's the lens that Vera just spoke about, but there's also this lens of what's occurring with our continued tensions with and growing tensions with China. When I was looking into this article, I found it interesting too that the issue in Punjab and this whole independence movement was directly related to the assassination of Indira Gandhi. So there is a history of violence here. I thought what Vera did was really important, though, is that she put her finger on this is going to be another excuse for Modi to amp up his own internal security services and use this as a rallying cry for his Hindu nationalism. Well, what's interesting to me, though, is that while in the past he's sort of poked at Pakistan, this is a minority group within India, which makes it actually easier for him to demonize given the history. So I expect there to be further crackdowns within India, and that's something I think we need to watch. And to give you a sense of how bad the blood is between India and Canada, and Canada is not normally known for sort of their aggressive behavior towards others. I mean, their reputation is sort of a go along, get along, it's not certainly not like the United States. It's they're certainly a much more peaceful people, I would say. But the Trudeau's plane had some sort of technical issue, which I find fascinating. And he was stuck in a hotel after the G20 for two additional days, refusing offers by the Indian government to lend him a plane. Now, there's all sorts of questions that I have about that, like how could the prime minister's plane break? also, why Canada couldn't get another plane there within the period of time. But also it shows you, though, that the decision for the security services in Canada was that it was safer for their prime minister to hole up in a hotel for a couple of days than it was to accept an offer of help from the Indian government. So this isn't one of these situations that's going to go quietly into the night. This is going to have some longer-term implications.
Fascinating. Jay?
Yeah, I think Vera really got into the geopolitical complexity of this. My initial reaction and my continuing reaction to this is that I'm kind of glad that Trudeau said something about this. That, you know, as we were talking before, I was reminded of the incident some years ago when Erdogan's bodyguards beat up Kurdish protesters right in Washington. And it was, you know, I remember thinking, where is my country on this? This is not how, I mean, this is a free speech issue. This is, you know, it's kind of felt to me to go to the heart of being on American soil should, you know, imply some rights and protections. On the other hand, I'm, you know, well aware that, you know, we do things overseas that are unsavory and, you know, or that we justify after the fact. So, you know, the one that comes to mind, of course, is bin Laden. You know, we felt it was justified to go over and assassinate him, and we did. But I was glad to see that Trudeau said, there's a line here, and you don't come to our country and kill people on Canadian soil. And yeah, it's like the nicest country, one of the nicest countries in the world. There's such nice people. I spent a lot of time there in the 80s. And, you know, the idea that this would happen. And I think that, you know, all the other political and geopolitical considerations aside, I think that's a fundamental thing that really strikes a chord with people. And I think it's going to strike a chord with Canadians who are just going to say, thank you for doing that.
Jay, do you think this has anything to do with our lack of official reaction to the Saudi Arabian situation?
The U.S. reaction?
Yeah. Right. That we sort of gave a tacit, it was a slap on the wrist, and now we're best friends again with the Saudis.
Yeah, I had Khashoggi on the list as well of, you know, things that we and the international community, you know, to a large degree just kind of said, oh, tisk tisk, mm-hmm. But that's about as far as it went. Yeah. And, you know, for a Canadian president to be the one who takes the strong reaction here about an infringement of rights on his on their soil is it's heartening that somebody did. I hope maybe, you know, this is a model for some other world leaders to say, don't do this.
It's actually not the first time that the Canadians have been pushing back against India. It was also related to the Tamil minority when, you know, the Indian government was extremely violent towards the Tamils. And a lot of Tamils, you know, Tamil nationalists live in Canada. So the Canadians and the Indian government have had a history of migratory patterns of ethno-religious minorities from India to Canada, and then these sort of, you know, well-organized diaspora communities that are trying to organize and push back. What's really interesting is how serious Modi takes the organizing of the Sikh minority or this particular group of the Sikhs, because what he was most offended about was the idea that Sikhs in Canada organized an independence vote, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in essence, what does it matter if, you know, the Sikhs in Canada have a hold of vote and bring it to the U.S. or the Australians or the Sikhs in the U.K. and the majority of those residents and citizens in those countries vote in favor of Sikh independence in the region of Punjab. You know, it's a very symbolic gesture. But the fact that Modi pushed so hard and sent an assassination team, from what it sounds like, to Canada as a reaction to this organizing, shows that he is extremely nervous and angry about symbolic acts. And he knows very well he can use that to fortify a Hindu nationalist unity in India against all minority communities. And that is an illiberal development, even further from what, you know, how we have criticized the Indian regime. So this is not a good sign for democracy in India.
We have gone around the room, but we have not heard from Terry Gibson yet. Terry, good morning.
Good morning. I really enjoyed listening to the conversation. I think a lot of great points were made. I think this is not only a warning to those who want to see democracy succeed not only in India, but I think it's a warning to those that want to see democracy succeed in the world. I think anytime you have an authoritarian leader like Modi using religion to move their agenda forward, you are moving into very troubled territory for maintaining a true democracy. And I worry about that happening in our country and other countries as well. I was also really happy to see Prime Minister Trudeau step forward and speak very vocally about this and take a hard position. I think that's the type of leadership that we need in the world today if we intend to preserve democracies. I'd like to see that kind of leadership here in the United States. Right now, clearly, Joe Biden has decided to stay relatively silent on this issue. And while you can understand politically why that choice might be made, the vision of him fist bumping the crown prince of Saudi Arabia comes to mind when I kind of think about how we handle these things in the United States. And I think that's going to be problematic moving forward for both Joe Biden and for our democracy. I think it's important to realize that India is now the most populated country on the planet, and it is therefore positioned to place a lot of leverage on a lot of smaller countries, including the United States. And the United States needs India's support for so many reasons, both economically and militarily, but other countries do too, and some of our enemies need their help as well. This is a really tricky situation for anyone in a leadership position to maneuver through, and I think that it is just the beginning of what is going to continue as long as Modi and other authoritarian leaders remain in power.
We've all touched on it, and I'm interested, Vera, let's begin with you. We'll start the cycle again, but what should the United States be doing? Terry talked about the muted response from President Biden. Should that be more?
I think there's a difference between how the Canadians and how the U.S., the British, and the Australians should respond. The Canadians should be out front because they have made the accusation. The other three countries ought to work very closely with each other to figure out a joint strategy to warn India to never consider doing anything like this in the other three countries, for the simple reason that the consequences will be extremely painful in terms of economic sanctions or other reactions. This is a diplomatic issue now for the other three countries. It needs to be discussed. A joint strategy has to be developed. Now, for Biden, this is complicated because he obviously would like to have improved relations with India for a number of reasons. This is a major slowdown on that path because, he cannot step away from joining the other allies and critiquing India, but he should probably do this behind closed doors rather than engage in a public performance as the Republicans appear to call for.
Yeah, Vera, I think again you're on target. I actually think it's going to be a more muted response than that. I think we'll hear words about ongoing investigation. We're not going to comment on a matter that's involved in, in internal to Canada's legal system, and then some sort of watered down milquetoast comment about appreciating the rights of all people to be independent. I'm going to put a couple of finer points on the comment I made about China, though, Joe. There's this really interesting arms race going on in the Pacific Ocean right now, where China has started to develop a series of naval bases around India. So if you start to think about the Pacific Ocean and then up towards Africa and into the Middle East, and the response from India has been to do something similar. So one is called the Pearl Choker, and the other is the Diamond Necklace. I don't develop these names. I just read about them. But when you look at this situation, though, you also need to look at the rising tension that is going on in Tibet between China and India right now, and there has been enough news about clashes between actually the military forces of both of the countries, and sort of this perverse way where they're almost coming down to fistfights because of sort of international rules about use of weapons in the area. But I mean, there's a lot of tension. There's an awful lot of tension in that area. So when Vera and the others have talked about the internal workings of India, it strikes me is that this is a move that it's sort of like a and I'm not diminishing the actions, but it's sort of like the opening gamut of a larger chess play going on.
Bob Griffin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, September 20th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, September 21st, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel discussion by investigative journalist and visiting professor at UAlbany, Rosemary Armeo, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman.
There's three possible stories that we could start off with this morning. Does anybody have a preference?
Well, I just saw that McCarthy is not going to meet with Zelensky today and have a forum. So I just want to say for a moment how despicable that is.
Oh, you're right.
Speaker McCarthy has announced that Ukrainian President Zelensky is in town today.
Yes.
In Washington, D.C. And he was supposed to host a forum with Republicans
right.
because of their concerns. And I just see a story that he's now
I'm
not
sure
even going to host
I'm sure he's busy taking care of the looming budget government shutdown crisis.
If only that were the case. If only that. Any case. So now what story do you?
That wasn't on the list.
Yeah, let's go to the top of the
bill. I want to do the Zelensky thing. Don't you love the fact that one man is leading his country into battle against what was the world's, say, third largest military? And the other man can't even muster the political courage to have a meeting.
To meet with him. It's so stunning. That's exactly what I was thinking. This man is leading his country in a way that surprises everyone. You know, he didn't come to this with a political background. What he's with, comedian, and he's done incredible things. His people are sacrificing. They're devoted to him. They're devoted to their country. He is doing this not only for the Ukraine but for the world. You know, trying to sustain some sort of democracy in the world and not a march. Holding back Putin, and. And House Speaker, Republican House Speaker McCarthy cannot take time to meet with him because his far right won't like it. I mean, that is just hideous.
Facing a right-wing rebellion in his ranks and mounting GOP resistance to aiding Ukraine has declined to convene a forum for President Volodymyr Zelensky to address members of the House today during a visit to Capitol Hill. While Mr. McCarthy is expected to meet with Mr. Zelensky privately, his decision not to host a meeting where the Ukrainian president could make a direct appeal to rank-and-file lawmakers underscores the deep Republican divisions over continued U.S. assistance for Kyiv's fight against the Russian invasion. It also reflects McCarthy's own precarious position as he draws ire from the right wing over federal spending and stepped-up threats to oust him if he does not embrace his members' priorities, which include cutting off money to Ukraine. The situation stands in contrast to the reception that Mr. Zelensky is receiving in the Senate, where Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, and the majority leader has organized a closed-door session in the Capitol for all 100 senators.
Right. To his credit, Senator Mitch McConnell feels it's very important, right, that they meet and they hear from him. And what signal does this send around the world?
It says Republicans are sick of paying for the war and they're not going to do it anymore, which we already know.
No, not because Mitch McConnell's a Republican and he's meeting with
him. And Mitch McConnell's power is in the dumpster right now.
Well, the Senate Republicans are meeting with him. I don't think that
the whole Senate's meeting with him under Schumer's auspices.
Exactly, right.
Now, you and I know that McConnell's view of our support for Ukraine differs from that of the far right.
Yes.
Berserker conference.
He
in the
made
House.
That clear yesterday.
Right.
I mean, I am no Mitch McConnell fan at all, but he does understand, you know, basic global issues and.
Well,
right, but then let's talk about
that. Dad would say, who my mom and dad are both military veterans, and as my dad would say, some of us remember when it was of critical importance to keep Russia at bay, and some people seem not to.
Right. And you got to wonder, is carrying Trump's water for him, you know, Trump is so pro-Putin. This is just hideous. You know, let's go to Tuberville because it's all intertwined, right? Because what about our military readiness? Because it's intertwined with no budget. It's intertwined with holding up the military. Yeah, it's all.
I mean, $24 billion for additional military and humanitarian aid for Ukraine's war. And I think, you know, it is interesting to think of what that meeting would be like if it did happen, because it obviously would be tense, I would think, wouldn't it?
But as of last night, it was going to be a quote-unquote select group of leadership, House Republican leadership, some committee chairs and, you know, top, you know, Republicans who focus on defense issues and other things. And certainly the country does need a conversation about whether, you know, how long do you continue to fund this? I mean, that's democracy. That's part of it. But to not have a House Republican meeting with him is just, to me, disrespectful.
Let's go to as Teresa rightly says, these are intertwined. And the Senate backed General Charles Q. Brown, Jr. of the Air Force for chairman and planned to advance promotions of two other military officials blockaded by Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama. The vote was 83-11 and was expected to be followed by confirmations of the Marine Corps and Army chiefs, which also have been held up for months by Mr. Tuberville, an Alabama Republican, over the Defense Department's abortion access policies. General Brown is set to succeed Army General Mark Milley when he steps down as Joint Chiefs Chairman at the end of the month. The Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York worked around Mr. Tuberville's roadblock by bringing up each individual nomination for a full Senate vote. But hundreds more promotions remain in limbo over objections by Mr. Tuberville. So explain to me why this could not have been done a long time ago.
Because Tuberville was right. This was a maneuver by Democrats to make Republicans look bad.
No.
Yes.
No.
Let me have my say first, and then you can answer, okay? Because I know that the rest of the whole panel is going to say, oh, Tuberville this, because I've been tisting too. And what he did is crappy. But it was not the crisis. Our whole armed forces was going to fall down and national security was at risk. They could have done this months ago. And Tuberville is also right that they could have done two or three appointments every day for a week. Schumer could have kept them home for their little August break and done all of them. This doesn't have to be a crisis. There was a way around it, which I wish I had known about. I did not. I hate that I'm just hearing that he had this this technique, and Tuberville was the one who announced it. Schumer's only doing it now because Tuberville was going to take credit for it. And the media, look at that. Look at what you just read. It's like, oh, Schumer figured out a way around it. No, that's not even true.
Yeah.
The Tuberville is right. This was all drama by the Democrats. So there.
All right. Teresa, go.
Not true.
It is.
Issue one.
I disagree.
I disagree.
You can start off with that. Okay.
Thank you. I disagree. There is technically a way around it. It's been discussed for a long time, but it's not feasible. There are 316 of these, and every one you fill, then you have to fill the next one. And it takes 30 hours of debate, and at any point, he could stop that. You logistically could not get all of these people confirmed and continue to get people confirmed in the way that you need to, doing it in this way, and continue to do the Senate business. Technically, it works, but practically, it does not. It does not work. And the only reason that they were able to do it in the shortened time that they did it yesterday is because when Tuberville found out that he was going to have to stay for the weekend, he allowed the Schumer folks to shorten the time. He didn't require them to use all the time they normally would. But when you place a hold, yes, there is a way around it, but a way around 300 now are backlogged, and then every one of those you fill, then that creates another backlog. This is an ongoing process, and the military cannot function this way. They cannot function with all of these vacancies.
This is the same as the Democrats saying, oh, the Republicans are completely blocking gun control. What they're doing is blocking a whole lot of it. They're being jerks, don't get me wrong. But the Democrats are doing nothing because they want all or nothing for political purposes. And that's exactly what they did
this time.
No,
they want the issue resolved where it should be resolved, which is on the NDAA.
They leave it at nothing? They leave it with no gun control and all the military, we've got people screaming that
the Iranians are going to attack. The problem here is not the Democrats. The problem here, and even the Republicans are beginning to say it, and that's why this move, because he met with his Republican caucus and they said, you cannot keep this up and not have a chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he said he just found out last week that the Joint Chiefs of Staff had to retire legally, that he didn't understand. He said, oh, Milley will stay around until this is resolved. Milley can't by law stay around, just like the head of the Navy, the top military leader of the Navy couldn't
just
stay around. And
that legal limit was there months ago when this began. Schumer could have done this. Why did he let the senators go home during August?
What's the underlying issue here, Rosemary?
The underlying issue is that this was not the way Democrats and the
way
we and the
media... No, the underlying issue is a policy issue. A policy issue.
Oh, yeah, okay, policy.
What's the policy issue?
Well, Teresa, if I may...
Abortion is the policy issue. And allowing...
But that mixes it all up.
He has a hold, not because he has an objection. He doesn't have an objection to these nominations. He's using that as a tool.
Correct.
Because he wants to bring attention to his objection to allowing military members and their family to leave the state and have their transportation paid if they want to get...
You are absolutely
care
right.
Out of
we
state,
know
which
this,
they
Teresa.
Already have that power.
We know
and
this,
the way
Teresa.
You fix that, the way you debate that, is a vote on the NDAA bill. It's a policy vote, and he is using this tool.
This is
that
why
has
the
never
Democrats are losing
because
they're thinking like you. We have to follow all the rules. The
yeah,
Republicans,
it's a democracy. You
no,
follow the rules.
No, the Republicans are not playing by those rules now. They're going. He found a loophole. Tuberville found a really great loophole to bring his issue to the forefront. And the Democrats always had the way around it and haven't used it until today.
But practically, you can't.
Oh, look,
not
Mark
time.
And Nick are here.
Sorry. Go ahead. Shut up. I'm done. I'm done. Sorry. I can't believe you're
Oh, wow. We have two other panelists.
I'm not supporting him. I'm saying that he beat the Democrats and we were stupid to allow it.
They beat
That's
him
not
yesterday.
Supporting him.
Go ahead, Mark. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think... So just I was the floor counsel and the second deputy counsel for the Senate majority, just disclosure. And I do think that there are, you know, it's a game of chess here. If you bring up individual appointments, there's unlimited time to debate those appointments. Democrats would be challenged on the abortion issue every single time for 300 appointments in unlimited debate. And it would give a window to the Republicans to face off on this particular issue. Like, that's what the GOP was trying to do, was to try to shed light on these abortion loopholes, as they think of them, for service members, and to target marginal members in the Democratic Party around their support of abortion, right? Like, it's not just, did we know there was loopholes? Of course people know they're not loopholes. They're just the the rules. They're the Senate floor rules. That they're not loopholes. That's just how it operates. And of course, they knew that they could have always done this. But there's no loophole in the Senate rules that isn't part of a conversation.
How come the Republicans are the only ones to use this? How about the whole thing about the election denier was Trump's lawyers figuring out that, hey, we can use this ceremonial.
But what she's saying is actually the other problem is the Democrats, the Republicans actually do not want the policy vote because they don't want to take that abortion policy vote. That's part of the problem with McConnell's hands are tied because McConnell knew he could do this, but he is trying to protect his Republicans from having to take this vote because the public is not with the Republicans on this issue.
I have a view sort of in the middle here. The procedure that allows Tuberville to put a hold on these nominations is a nicety. It's not in our Constitution, for God's sake. Right. And it's a bit arcane that the Senate needs to approve a book of 300 names. So long run, you got to change that. The Democrats, I think Rosemary's right in the following sense. The Democrats wanted to make Tuberville look bad, so they walked around for weeks looking feckless and claiming that the sky was falling. They shouldn't have done either. They should have let him twist for a bit and look stupid, and then they should have got on with it. Because the problem the Democrats had is they were saying, this is bad for our national security. Well, you know what, Chuck Schumer? If something's bad for my national security and you can fix it, even if it requires having a cot in your office, I want you to fix it. I've worked 100-hour weeks. The congressional estimate was 700 hours. That's 7 weeks of work, and you're done. Now, I understand Teresa's going to tell me there's a continual backlog. But you know what? You force the issue and make Tuberville look bad by solving it under the current constraint, and you put so much pressure on the Republicans that they all agree that maybe that the lieutenant general in charge of the Antarctic isn't somebody that we need to approve on an ongoing basis. Maybe we can trust and designate that authority elsewhere. So I think what Tuberville has done that started this is abhorrent. By the way, Mitch McConnell's found it politically convenient, as he always does, to tuck in behind somebody else and just let them take the lead and the flack because he doesn't want the Senate to have to vote on this. And the Democrats have done what they too often do, which is run around ineffective and screaming about a problem that they actually can in large measure fix. That's where I come out on this.
I think that really hits the nail on the head. I think both of those things are true. And, you know, as much as the Democrats try to capitalize on the opportunity, I think they could have done that in a shorter period of time and not allowed this to be drawn out. Like, the impact on, you know, military veterans was made, and then kind of that momentum was lost with the sort of drawn out discussion around the issue.
Nick Rangel on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, September 21st. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, or facts may have changed or evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's show after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Friday, September 22nd, Joe Donahue was out of the office and I filled in. I was joined for the panel by former EPA Regional Administrator, President of Beyond Plastics, and faculty member at Bennington College, Judith Ank, diplomat in residence at Bard College, Frederick Hoff, and Albany County District Attorney, David Soares.
We are going to talk about a looming government shutdown, this from the AP, with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy's latest funding plan in ruins and lawmakers leaving town for the weekend, there's no endgame in sight as hard-right Republicans push dangerously closer to a disruptive federal shutdown. McCarthy has repeatedly tried to appease his hard right flank by agreeing to the steep spending cuts they're demanding to keep government open. But cheered on by former President Trump, more on that later, the Republican frontrunner for president for 2024, the conservatives have all but seized control of the House. In a crushing defeat Thursday, a handful of Republican hardliners blocked a typically popular defense bill from advancing. The second time this week, it was set back, which is an unheard-of loss for a House Speaker. Even a stopgap bill to keep government funding past the September 30th deadline, called a continuing resolution, is a non-starter for some on the right flank. We need extreme MAGA Republicans to get their act together, said House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York, referring to Trump's Make America Great Again slogan, of course. One of Trump's top allies, Rep. Matt Gaetz of Florida, who is leading the hard right flank, said the House Republicans now have almost no choices left but to spend the time it takes to pass each of the 12 bills needed to fund the government, typically a laborious process, even if it means going into a shutdown. Or they can join with Democrats to pass a continuing resolution, which is sure to put McCarthy's job at risk. What Gaetz has said, and several others, would not do is vote for a continuing resolution that fails to slash spending. The open revolt is further evidence that McCarthy's strategy of repeatedly giving in to the conservatives is seemingly only emboldening them, allowing them to run roughshod over their own House majority. Their conservative bills have almost no chance in the Senate. Fred.
Yeah, sometimes you have to wonder why Kevin McCarthy wants to hold on to this job. It's just one humiliation after another. But I must say he's bringing a good deal of it on himself. I mean, one thing that stuns me is, Kevin McCarthy is Speaker of the House. He is in command in the House. So with the prospect of the U.S. government being unable to pay wages to federal employees, unable to do all kinds of things fiscally, he lets the House of Representatives adjourn for a long weekend. I don't understand this. Stay in session. Work this out. Now, on the a more positive side of things, if there is a so-called government shutdown on the 1st of October, it's not as potentially catastrophic as what could have happened last June, if the debt ceiling had not been increased. A shutdown that lasts a few days, even a couple of weeks, will not have a catastrophic effect on the economy. It'll have a lot of inconvenience for many people. Federal workers will not be paid. Uniformed military personnel will not be paid until the shutdown ends. People will be paid retroactively. But this is a tremendous hardship, and all of this is entirely gratuitous. My own sense is that one way forward is something that is being discussed by a couple of New York State Republican congressmen, Lawler and Molinaro. And this is bringing forward a continuing resolution that would keep the government open, that would give Congress a chance to do its work, which is to legislate and appropriate. Okay, there are 12 appropriations bills that make up the U.S. federal budget. Only one has been passed. This is a situation that has gone on for decades under Democrats and Republicans in control of Congress. What conceivably could happen is a group of moderate Republicans will join with Democrats to offer a continuing resolution keeping the government in business, and even permitting Speaker McCarthy to keep his fingerprints off it, even permitting Speaker McCarthy to vote no on the continuing resolution. But presumably there would be enough votes, 214 or whatever, Democrats and a handful of Republicans to get this passed. So McCarthy could presumably vote no and maybe hang on to his job. But just to bring things full circle, I'm beginning to wonder why he even wants to hang on to this job.
Right. Well, and I don't mean to sound naive, but it's so many games. Like, you're like, please take care of the country. And they're like, we have a lot of games to play first.
Yeah. And look, an agreement was reached in June between the Speaker and the President of the United States on fiscal year 2024 spending levels, $1.6 trillion. This agreement is in place. Now there is a small handful of House Republicans who are saying, no, we want to renege on that agreement. We want to drop to $1.4 trillion. And that's just a non-starter. But as the Speaker has said, these are about his own party members. These are people willing to torch the place, and I don't understand it.
Judith?
Oh, I understand it. It's Speaker Matt Gaetz is the very poorly informed and not working in the public interest Congress member from Florida. He is really taking control of the House, and it's a problem that that the House is controlled by Republicans narrowly. We kind of saw this coming when it took 15 votes for McCarthy to be voted Speaker. And I'm not as optimistic that this is going to be resolved in any useful way. I mean, there is a local angle here. What Matt Gaetz is now pushing is he's very much against continuing resolutions. And he says he just assumes there's going to be a government shutdown. It's inevitable. So he wants, as Fred described, he wants to bring a series of different GOP-drafted appropriation bills to the floor, but he knows that that's not going to prevent a shutdown. Politico nationally has a story today on this, and it includes the following information. Matt Gaetz has a surprising partner in this plan, Representative Mark Molinaro, a New York moderate who is one of the 18 House Republicans representing a district carried by Joe Biden. Molinaro has been involved in various attempts to solve the shutdown crisis this week, including the bipartisan effort to use a discharge petition to force a vote on a continuing resolution. He's working with Matt Gaetz on a plan to kill the continuing resolution. So, you know, one thing that says to me is, journalists, note to self, stop referring to Mark Molinaro as a moderate. He's not. He's the sidekick of Matt Gaetz now at a really important moment in Washington. I mean, it's amazing. We're just over a week away. My great concern, because the Republicans in the House are in such disarray, my great concern is that they're not going to reach agreement. We'll have a shutdown that can last a really long time. I mean, there have been a lot of shutdowns, way too many. There have been 20 federal government shutdowns since 1976. The longest was 35 days during the Trump administration. The average government shutdown is 8 days. And I can tell you, the federal government is, you can't just flip a switch and say, okay, we're shutting down tomorrow. Federal agencies are spending all of their time today planning for the shutdown. I was at EPA during the Obama administration in 2013 when we had a 16-day shutdown. And what that involves is, as Fred mentioned, most federal employees are furloughed, meaning you can't do any work whatsoever. And there's real anxiety because traditionally when the furlough period ends, federal employees will get back pay. But you have a number of federal staff who are living paycheck to paycheck, important administrative support people, who can't, miss a couple paychecks. And then there's always the unknown. Will they really get retroactive pay? Members of Congress, by the way, continue to get paid. A lot of people won't notice it because mail delivery is not affected. You know, the classic example is national parks and monuments are shut down. But it really causes tremendous disruption, and it costs the federal government a lot of money. There are some economic impacts, and also it really diminishes our standing in the world that the House of Representatives has been reduced to this. But here's the big worry. Matt Gaetz and his very small but influential crowd in the House is running the show today, and it's not going to end well.
I want to ask you all why, when there's no chance for the bills to pass in the Senate, why you think they bother mull over that question of mine. David Source.
Yeah. Well, I think all of the best points have been made by Judith and Fred here. But your question, of course, which I think is one of the most important questions, is what's the point of all of this when you have a Democratic majority Senate, you have a Democratic president that will never, be on board with anything that this the suicide squad of a caucus led by Matt Gaetz and his other friends would look to pass. You don't get to control the government of the United States with the numbers within that caucus. You don't get to dictate cuts to spending when you have the other two parties that are necessary in order to make those cuts a reality. You don't get to do that. So then the question is, well, what's the motive here? The motive here is simply, hey, I'm not really doing this job to help people. I'm here to raise money for myself and to be viewed. I mean, track this, right? Track every single statement that's being made by someone like Matt Gaetz and his caucus, and then track the amount of fundraising materials that are going out, you know, from their campaign offices. And the sad and perverse part is they're going to be rewarded for it because that's who they appeal to. And that's the there is a culture that enables them. Now, as far as I think the politics, you are so right on, Fred. What's different about this shutdown, talks about this shutdown and previous talks, is the fact that the vast majority of the criticisms are coming from moderate Republicans. I think I heard one from Hakeem Jeffries, but the vast majority of public condemnation is coming from members of the Republican Party that want to get this done because they can appreciate the consequences, both politically but also the impact on people's lives. Again, Judith mentioned the number of military personnel who won't, you know, be cashing in a paycheck. The contractors, as you said, Judith, you know, the federal employees, they get back pay for however long the government is shut down, but independent contractors, who there are many of, they won't be receiving, you know, those rewards. I think the only way out for the speaker is to present an opportunity like much of what you discussed. It's to have a group of moderate Republicans working together with the Democrats, bringing some resolutions to the floor and having those resolutions passed in that way. And then McCarthy saying he had nothing, you know, to do with it, no fingerprints of his involved, although he will be caught in a hot mic or something else that is in tradition of being Mr. McCarthy. He can't help himself but do this. But you're going to see that party implode within this next week.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Fred. Sorry.
No, please, Judith, after you.
So I think David puts his finger on it. There is a way out of here. We just need a handful of moderate Democrats to vote. I'm sorry, moderate Republicans to vote with the Democratic majority, assuming you get all of the Democrats together. And, you know, they can negotiate a bill with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. But anticipating that, a lot of the more strident, uninformed MAGA crowd in the House has already said, if the scenario, which is so logical that David outlined, if that happens, Trump and others will go after the moderate Republicans who team up with Democrats to pass a reasonable budget. And so these so-called moderate Republicans have to decide, are they going to, you know, do what's right and keep the country running, kind of a big deal, or are they going to stand down because they're worried about Trump and MAGA going after them? And I just want to make one more point. There are some really legitimate fiscal concerns here. There is a lot of waste in federal government, but you don't hear, you know, fiscal conservatives saying, I'm going to vote this way because this program is bloated or this program is unaccountable. This is just all performative politics. As David said, they want to get on Fox News. They don't, you know, they don't really care what the impact is on everyday Americans. They just want to get on Fox and they want to curry favor with Trump. And Trump is actively promoting this. So on a certain level, I want to amend what I said earlier about the power of Matt Gaetz. The power here really rests with Lawler and Molinaro and other Republicans who really need to be the adults in the room and literally work with Democrats to reach an agreement with the Senate and get the government not to shut down.
We also hear from John, who says the end game of the Republicans is to destroy the administrative state. People need to know that the federal government protects workers' rights, workers' safety, transportation safety, the protection of our investments in the stock market, the quality of our air and water, and many other parts of our life. Maybe if voters can figure this all out, they'll vote for politicians who will be responsible.
Yeah, I'm not so sure I'd paint the entire Republican Party with a broad brush here. But look, even for centrist Republicans, and let's just say for the sake of argument, this includes people like Molinaro and Lawler. They've got a real problem. I don't know the details of what Mark Molinaro is doing with Gaetz and all of this, but here's the problem. In order to prevail in general elections, in districts that have a lot of Democrats, these Republicans have to be seen as doing their jobs in Congress seriously. They have to be legislating. They have to be operating on a bipartisan basis whenever they can. But doing those things also puts them in danger of being primaried by MAGA Republicans. Yeah. I can almost guarantee that if Lawler and Molinaro play a role with Democrats in bringing forward a continuing resolution, they will be primaried, and Donald Trump will be a driving force behind that.
Well, if you had a good speaker, right, or a good leader, you're not asking, you know, any of your members who are in contentious districts to put themselves at risk. What you're doing is you're looking around the entire congressional district map and you're finding, hey, here's the congressman who represents one of the largest naval bases, you know, in the country, or one or those people who are ultimately going to be impacted on a daily basis by government shutdowns. You identify those areas, and those are the individuals that you begin to engage, because trust me, if you're a service member, you are going to be feeling the pain of a government shutdown more so than anyone in this room.
David Soares on the Roundtable panel on Friday, September 22nd. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at WAMC.org or via podcast. This has been the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.